Awesome. Well, yeah, as Mike said, I was here a long time ago. This was actually my childhood church, and I have great memories of youth, of kids' church or kids' club or whatever it's called now, and youth group. Cut my teeth water skiing, and yeah, it was just a really awesome time. But that was 20 years ago, and it feels like a lifetime. Been to university, been a teacher, been a pastor, started a family. As Mike said, unfortunately, my wife couldn't be here. She's got another family thing happening. We've lived on the North Island, and now we live in Central Otago in sunny Alexandra. And my wife and I look after a church over there. So it's full, and there's lots of exciting things happening. But throughout that whole time, I've had a real passion for learning. Whether it's practical or philosophical or mechanical or just any new thing, I really, really enjoy learning new things. And I think that's partly because God has given us a brain and he wants us to use it. And I don't know about you, but when you look at around sort of the world, it seems to be that there's some people who use more of their brain than the rest of us. And there is some people that our society would recognize as being especially gifted. They are intelligent, they are imaginative, they are inventive, they're innovative. And in our culture, we would call those people a genius. And so the common way to work out if someone is a genius is typically known as an IQ test. Now here's a little test. What does IQ stand for? Does anybody know? Yes. Oh, hello. You even know how to say the second word properly. Okay. So it's not intelligent quotient, it's intelligent quotient. Okay. And it's basically just a measure of your intelligence. So I thought we've obviously got some standout children here today, some geniuses amongst us. I thought it might be a good idea to just do a little IQ test here this morning to sort of see if there's any geniuses at Orwell Street. Are you okay with that? No. I didn't think you would come to church and sign up to have to take a test, but the good news is it's really simple. I'm going to make it multi-choice, okay? So that's always easy. You got like a 25% chance of getting it. And there is no prizes other than the sheer fact of knowing that you are a genius, okay? So how do you feel about that now? Still pretty ambivalent. Okay, all right, well, that's fine. We're going to crack on with it, and you don't have to write anything down, just call out your answers or sort of wait until other people call out their answers and then decide. Okay, very easy. The first one is this. These are from a legitimate IQ test, by the way. I didn't make them up. And which word can logically replace the question mark? Here's the statement. Water is to a pipe as something is to a wire. Is it a cord? Is it electricity? Is it heat? Or is it gas? Okay, who thinks that's the cord? Who thinks it's electricity?
Yeah.
Ooh, majority. Ooh, could be right, could be wrong. Who thinks it's heat? Gas? You are correct. Okay, electricity, that is one from one. Does everybody get it, or do you want me to explain it? Okay, that's fine. Right, that's good. Let's move on. Second question is this. Which number logically comes next in the series? 4, 6, 9, 6, 14, 6, something. Is it 6? 17, 19, or 21? All right, who thinks it's the first one? A, 6. No, okay, that's good, good. Who thinks it's 17? 19. 21. All right, the answer is 19. Well done if you're a maths person. Sorry if you're not a maths person and got that one wrong, but that's okay. So 19, do you know how it is? It's an extra 5 every time, 4, 9, 14, 21. That's what the answer said anyway. All right, third one. This is a little bit more complicated. Casey needs to move 23 huge boxes from his truck to the loading dock. Okay, real world example here. His forklift could only hold 3 boxes at once. How many times does Casey have to visit the loading dock? 5, 6, 7, or 8? Right, I can see you're sort of like just working that out. It's good. I'll give you a little bit of time. Okay, right. Next. Who thinks it's 5? 6, 7, 8. Oh, look at you guys. You're pretty good. Pretty good. Okay. All right, fourth question. which of the shapes below can be composed from the loose parts? So the loose parts up there, which of these shapes, A, B, C, or D, can fit together in that configuration? I'll give you a minute to think. It's like an exam, you know? With the... It's long enough. Okay. Is it A? B? C? Is everyone waiting to see what everyone says? Okay, D. All right. I'm impressed. Okay, it is D. All right, it is very good. Okay, last question. So most of you are tracking 4 from 4. This is a chance for you to get 5 out of 5, 100%, which is pretty good for an IQ test. Okay, are there 53 letters in this sentence? Yes or no? You guys are so quiet. I actually just made that question up and put it in there to see if you would sit there silently and count. That's not a proper IQ test question, okay? I just thought I'd see if you were going to go with it. The answer, if you really want to know, is no. But someone's figured that out. All right. You can continue on and do these IQ tests if you're into them. They're on the internet. But don't do what I did. So I signed up. On a webpage, there was 40 questions, I had 20 minutes, and I was banging through it, and I was concentrating really hard. There was questions around numbers, and patterns, and words, and all sorts of stuff, and I was feeling pretty good. I thought, I'm going to get a pretty good score here, and then when I submitted my final answer, 40 questions, submitted my final answer, up popped up this little pop-up, and it said, please pay $50 to find out your IQ score, and I was gutted, because I didn't want to pay $50. So I don't know what my IQ is, but clearly it's very low because I got sucked into that website. You know, scientists say that the average person has an IQ of between 85 and 115. So that's probably the majority of us, right? 68%, around about 2/3 of us, probably fit somewhere in the middle of that bell curve. If you have an IQ of over 115, but less than 130, you are known as very bright. And I'm sure that many of you would probably fit into that. If you're 130 to 145, you are classified as very gifted. And there's only 2% of the population have that. And if you are over 145 in your IQ test, you are classified as a genius. Or Donald Trump, possibly. You'd have to check the stats on that, I'm not sure. But that's only 0.1% of the population, so a very, very small amount. And you'd probably recognize some of these famous geniuses. They had very high IQs. Albert Einstein, the theoretical physicist, he was 160. Marie Curie, a chemist, she did radioactivity research, think X-rays, that sort of stuff. Only lady to win the Nobel Prize twice. She had an IQ of 180. Or Nikola Tesla, the guy who did a whole lot of electrical engineering stuff, and 190 was a pretty smart guy. So you probably recognize that. And we're probably not in that sort of category, I guess, if we're honest. But social scientists agree that the IQ is not really the only measure of a genius. In fact, actually, an IQ test is quite a limited form. It can't really test creativity very well. And it doesn't really measure empathy, two really important human characteristics. And so scientists have started to define genius as being much more than intelligence. And if you look through the pages of history, you'll see that the real measure of a genius is the legacy that they leave, the shape, the influence they've had in shaping our world. And so some famous geniuses were not only intelligent, but they were also pioneers in their field. They challenged the status quo. They made the impossible possible. They could see things beyond and before anybody else. They had a new way of seeing the world. They had ideas that were revolutionary, insights that were just absolutely amazing. And so by that measure, you could argue that Jesus Christ is the greatest genius that the world has ever seen. I mean, he was innovative. He was creative. He was visionary. He was revolutionary. He challenged the status quo. He had fresh ideas and new perspectives. He, in virtually every aspect of human life, Jesus brought a new way of thinking and being. And the genius of Jesus is that he taught us what it meant to be fully alive, to be the people that we were created to be. And I think that's actually what sets Jesus apart from the rest of history's geniuses. Because often a genius would give the world something new, maybe a new piece of music or a new art form or some new technology. And those geniuses, they would shape the world to be a better place, but they would not necessarily shape us to be better people. That's what Jesus did. Through his teachings and through his truth, not only did he change the course of world history, but he transformed us people to be better. And there's one aspect of human life where Jesus had a radical influence, and it's in this area, the area of power. So let me ask you a question. There's six people here from New Zealand, six pretty famous people. Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister, Dame Cindy Kiro, the Governor General, Adrian Orr, Reserve Bank guy, Mark Robinson, New Zealand Rugby CEO, Hilary Barry, everyone's favourite TV presenter, or Peter Jackson, the film director. Of those six, and I know it's a limited list, but of those six, who do you think is the most powerful person in New Zealand? Feel free to call out your answers when you're ready.
I'd say a toss-up between both corners, top and bottom.
Okay, so you're hedging your bets, as usual. All right, anybody going to make it a definitive? So you're saying Jacinda and Sir Peter Jackson. She has the ear of the nation. Wow, that is power.
Most
powerful.
In
New Zealand.
Inside our country.
Probably. Do you want to change your answer?
Oh, no, she's very local. She has no power outside New Zealand, whereas Jacinda and Peter Jackson have global influence.
Global influence, yeah, okay. Pretty significant. Okay, anybody else? That was a good answer. Good answer. Any others? Yep. Okay. All right. Good. All right. Let's take it up a notch. Let's go global. Okay. So there are six people here on the screen. Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, King Charles III, brand new, Tim Cook from Apple, or Pope Francis. Who is the most powerful person in the world in your estimation? The Apple guy? Why is that? Oh, okay, let's get deep in conspiracy theories. Okay, Apple controls the elections. Maybe, I don't know, I've not really researched that. Anybody want to go for someone else?
How many Catholics are in the world?
At least 1 billion.
How many Chinese are in the world?
1.3 billion.
Russians?
Not that many. Okay, there's quite an analytical aspect happening over here. Anybody else?
Today, Mr. Putin could destroy the world almost.
He could. Doesn't make him very... He would probably be low on the IQ test, that's what you're saying? Yeah. I think he's kept his score not in the public knowledge. So he could push a couple of buttons and put in some codes, and that could be the end of most of Europe. But... does that make him bright? Probably not, but it does make him pretty powerful. Anything else? Anybody else? Tough one, isn't it? Okay. I'll take the Apple answer. That's good. I'm happy with that. All right, let's just go a little bit bigger than that. Okay, we've gone New Zealand. We've gone world. Let's go through history. So Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Muhammad, Genghis Khan, Napoleon, or Queen Victoria. Out of these six, and again, this is a very limited list, could have chosen hundreds of people, who do you think is the most powerful person on this list in your estimation?
Who killed the most people?
Probably Mr. Khan. Yep.
Israel.
Yep.
And Jesus
is
returning to Israel.
So you think Napoleon was aware of that and kind of prepping the field for that? Okay. All right. Good answer. Anything else?
Muhammad must have a strong ongoing.
He does have a significant influence, yep, yep. Interesting, okay. Well, I'll let you ponder that. But my point is this, those people, probably not Hillary Barry, but most of the others, are pretty powerful in their control, in their command over significant people. In fact, a number of them built huge empires. They controlled armies, they had political prestige, social status. I mean, their decisions influenced millions and millions of people. And so for much of human history, that's really how power has been defined. Across continents, across cultures, power has been about conquest and control. But then 2,000 years ago, Jesus entered our world and he had a radically different attitude to power. Jesus taught that power was not about command, it was not about conquest, it was not about control, it was about service and about sacrifice. This is what he said, "Whoever is least among you is the greatest. Or those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Or in this world the kings and great men lord it over their people, but among you it will be different. Those who are the greatest among you should take the lowest rank, and the leader should be like a servant." And so Jesus radically redefines power. He reframed what people thought a powerful person looked like, and that was a stroke of genius. But like most geniuses, Jesus wasn't really recognized in his day. So you might be aware that in the first century, the Jewish people were doing life pretty tough. They'd been conquered and absorbed into the Roman Empire. And a proud people, Jewish people, they felt powerless. And so there was this deep-seated hatred between the Romans and the Jews. And after centuries of oppression, the Jews just longed for freedom. They just looked forward to the day when the Roman foot would be off their neck. And so many Jews thought that revolution was the only option, that if the Jewish people would just rise up and violently resist the Romans, they could be free from tyranny. And so against this really, really tense backdrop, Jesus turns up and he preaches peace. So we're going to read some of his words from Matthew chapter 5 in the Bible. If you've got a Bible, I invite you to turn there or swipe there. Otherwise, I'm going to put it up on the screen for you. All right, this is what we read. Matthew chapter 5. Jesus said this, "You have heard the law says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you'll be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." You know, sometimes when we read the Bible, we superimpose our own assumptions onto the text. And I guess we often forget that democracy was not a popular political system in ancient times. When Jesus was born, his world was full of oppression. In fact, Jesus and his people were essentially captives in their own country. And so when Jesus turns up and he's teaching people to love their enemies, he's really going against the grain. I mean, most of the Jews were seeking revenge and retaliation against the Romans. But Jesus taught that there was another way. He brought a fresh perspective on power, that power was not about violence or coercion or command or control or abuse, but instead there was a different option. This is what he says also in that chapter. "You have heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also. If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his pack for a mile, carry it 2 miles. I don't know what you think when you read that stuff, but it's easy to dismiss Jesus as just totally on another planet, you know, like hid in the clouds as some sort of half-baked hippie turning up, you know, preaching love and peace and all that sort of stuff. It just seems so different to the world that he was in. But Jesus was grounded in the everyday realities of his people. I mean, these were not hypothetical situations for his listeners. So if a Roman soldier was tanked up and just spoiling for a fight, he would slap a young Jewish person in the face. Now, according to Roman law, a soldier was not allowed to critically injure someone unless they were provoked. So a slap in the face is just kind of a deliberate attempt to disrespect someone. It's an attempt to diminish the Jewish power and their dignity. And so Jesus is saying, when you courageously stand and when you offer your enemy the other cheek, you reveal that it is not your power that is diminished. And you need to know that turning the other cheek does not mean that you get walked over, especially if there's an unhealthy relationship or some sort of abusive environment. Like that's certainly not what Jesus was talking about here. Abuse is always wrong and it needs to be called out, and you need to get help if that's your situation. But Jesus is trying to highlight that it's those who are truly powerful are those who have strength of character, who have the inner freedom to stand strong despite their circumstances and the challenges that they face. Someone who knew what it was like to turn the other cheek was a man called Nelson Mandela. He lived in South Africa, and in the mid-1960s, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for his role in some anti-government sabotage. So for the next 27 years, he lived in a cramped cell. During the rainy season, it was damp and cold. He had no bed. He was forced to sleep on a straw mat on the concrete floor. He had no pajamas. They were only available to white prisoners. And he spent his days breaking rocks out in the beating South African sun. Because of his imprisonment, he missed out on raising his children. He was unable to attend the funerals of his mother and of his eldest son. In fact, for many years, Nelson Mandela was only allowed to write and receive one letter every 6 months. And he was only allowed to meet with one visitor for 30 minutes once a year. But despite those really terrible conditions, Mandela stood strong. In the face of racism and oppression, he was able to turn the other cheek. And so when Mandela was officially released on the 11th of February 1990, the world discovered that while he had been imprisoned for 27 years, he had always been free. 4 years after his release, he was elected as the first South African black president. And instead of using his new power to seek revenge, he used his power to bring his nation together, to choose to forgive his oppressors and actually set up a commission for racial equality and justice. Now, hopefully you never have to experience some of the horrors of imprisonment or racism, but there'll be times when you have been wronged. There'll be times when you have made to be feel powerless. And Jesus encourages us here never to let the actions of another lead you to be less. Whatever power someone may hold over you, they are powerless to change your character. And so notice what Jesus says. After telling his listeners to turn the other cheek, he then says, if someone's going to sue you and take your shirt off your back, you should give them your coat as well. And I can just imagine the crowds that are listening and they're just shaking their head in disbelief. I mean, if someone's going to take something from you, something that they don't deserve, why would you give them more? But this is where the real genius of Jesus shines through. In fact, the best way to confront greed is with generosity. And see, generosity has nothing to do with your income level. I know people who have lived in poverty and they are incredibly generous. And I know people who are incredibly wealthy and they have lacked generosity. Generosity is all about an attitude. And according to Jesus, the generous are the powerful. You may not be free to do less than is required of you, but you are always free to do more. So, for example, you're not free probably to turn up late to work, right? But you are free to show up early. Or you may have to attend school, but you can do more than just attend. You can help your teacher in the classroom. Or you might have a list of chores or jobs or whatever that you've got to do at home. You can choose to do those joyfully and with gratefulness. You might have some family members who depend on you for the basics, but you can go above and beyond with your care. You're probably legally obligated to pay your taxes, but no one can stop you being generous with your money. And that's where generosity totally confuses the greedy. I mean, when someone tries to exert power over you by taking something of yours, instead of holding tightly to it, if we openly give it to them, in fact, if we give more than they're wanting, it just messes with their head. They don't know what's going on. And the whole attitude of generosity is just different to our world. Like in the Western world, it's all about holding tightly to our stuff. But Jesus calls us to a better way, a way of generosity and goodness. There's an American author and activist called Erwin McManus, and he puts it like this: if you are convinced that God is always more generous than you, it becomes easier to be generous with what you have. And we're not talking just about your stuff. We're talking about your time, your energy, your service of others. That's the genius of Jesus. Well, Jesus makes a final challenge, and it's a very real-world scenario for his listeners. You'll see there he talks about carrying the Roman soldiers' pack. Well, Romans were famous for their roads. And along the main roads of the Roman network, there were stones. These stones, these markers, were the measure of 1 mile. It's where we get our word milestone from. Every mile, there was a stone. And so according to Roman law, soldiers could force any Jew to carry their pack 1 mile. Now, if you want to know like the distance, that's basically from this church down to Countdown, downtown. That's the distance of 1 mile. And if a Jew refused to do that, they would be arrested and flogged. So you've got to appreciate that this is a pretty big inconvenience. I mean, the packs would have been heavy. Some historians estimate that those Roman soldiers' packs were more than 20 kgs. But it is more than an inconvenience. This is a deliberate attempt to diminish the power of the Jews. Because the whole experience is hugely humiliating for the Jewish person. First, they've got to walk 1 mile carrying the soldier's pack, and they're more like a mule than a man. And then they have to walk 1 mile back to where they started. This time, they're not carrying a heavy pack. They're carrying the shame of being forced to work like a slave. But even in the midst of these difficult circumstances, Jesus says there is a new path to power. When a soldier demands that you carry his pack a mile, carry it 2 miles. In other words, when you are forced to serve, let serving be your force. Do more than is required. Do more than is expected. And can you just imagine the look on the Roman soldier's face when he says to the Jew, "All right, scum, give me my pack back. We've made it a mile." And the Jew looks at him and insists on carrying his pack another mile. "Give me my pack back. I'm good. I'm not tired. I will go the extra mile." Who has the real power in that moment? See, the genius of Jesus is that he recognized humility was more powerful than arrogance. That generosity is more powerful than greed. That service is more powerful than obligation. Jesus knew that real power never needs to flex a muscle, never needs to wear a uniform, never needs to point a gun, never needs to accumulate wealth. The power that is unseen is greater than the power that needs to be seen. And this radical approach to power that Jesus had has had a huge influence on our world. So in ancient times, it was never considered that powerful people should use their power for the good of others. If you went up to Alexander the Great and you're like, hey, Alex, because obviously you'd be on first name sort of casual basis, you probably wouldn't be, he'd probably kill you. So, you know, hello, Alexander the Great. Perhaps you should consider the people you are conquering. He would look at you like you're an idiot. Or if you went up to Julius Caesar and you said, you know, Julius, you should probably think about providing care for some of your subjects, he would just think you're absurd. Or if you went to Genghis Khan and you said, you know what, you should use your power for the greater good, it is just utterly ridiculous. In the ancient world, the powerful people had the absolute right to do whatever they wanted, and they believed that they would use their power for conquest and control. But Jesus turns all that upside down, and he starts a conversation around what power is for. And that's why over the centuries, our modern expectation is that governments and that leaders, they should protect the poor. They should help the homeless and the hungry. That's why we believe that racial equality and social justice are really important goals. Jesus taught that power should be used not to overpower, but to empower. For those with power, they should serve and support others to benefit the common good. And you've probably seen this idea filtered down through some of the big issues of our modern world, the Me Too movement, or the Black Lives Matter movement, or even in New Zealand, you know, the Waitangi Tribunal sorting out reparations for historic injustices against Māori. All of those, and a whole lot of others, have been influenced by Jesus' idea that power should be used for the good of others, that power is not to be used to control, but to create. Now you might think, well, that is lovely. But what does that mean for me, for you? Because clearly we're not the most powerful people in the world, right? I mean, we're probably not even the most powerful people in New Zealand. Our decisions that we make don't affect thousands or millions of people. I mean, sometimes we probably don't even have the power to get our kids to brush their teeth. I wonder if you could do me a favor and if you've got a cell phone, pull it out. Turn it on. You're allowed to turn it on. This is church. Well, I said you're allowed to turn it on in church. And have a look and see how many contacts you have in your cell phone list. Okay? Should be listed at the top or at the bottom of your cell phone contact list somewhere. All right. Have you found it? Don't count them all up. It should just do it automatically. But if not, don't stress. Okay. Has anybody got more than 100 contacts in their cell phone? Okay, that's good. More than 150? Ooh, all right. More than 200? 300? Whoa, okay, all right. We're going to keep going until we see who gets the most. This is a competition.
I can't tell how many I've got.
It says at the top. Okay. Yeah, it might be the bottom. If you've got one of those Tim Cook Apple iPhones, yeah, rubbish. Okay, if you've got more than 500, just under. More than 500, that's impressive. Okay, because the average is about 150, okay? So if you're like 400 or 500, you are, you know, shooting way over. Most people range between 100 to 300, you know, numbers in their cell phone. Now, here's the thing. You might not think that you are a powerful person because of the position you have, but that is not what real power is. According to your cell phone, you know people. You have influence, connection with people. And all of us are connected and have influence. Maybe it's in the workshop, in the office, at school, on the farm, on your sports team, with our neighbors, with our family, with our friends. You are connected. And so that means that all of us have the possibility to use our power, the power that we have, to empower others. To show humility when we are wronged. To be generous in the face of greed. To serve because we want to rather than we have to. And maybe for you that means showing some self-restraint at work when your colleague starts saying some things that are untrue. Maybe for you it's about showing, generously giving some of your money to a charity or a campaign or something. Maybe it's just graciously helping your aging parents sort out their affairs, or giving up an afternoon to tidy the backyard for a sick neighbour or something. You know, but when we do those simple actions, when we use our power for good, when we construct rather than control, when we empower rather than overpower, we are living out the genius of Jesus. And that's my encouragement for you today. Let's pray. God, we are grateful for the genius of Jesus. And not only did he revolutionize our world, but he makes us better people. And so we just ask that we would live out that genius, that humility, that generosity, that service that Jesus did and shows and teaches us. This week, in the places we go, and the people we meet, may we show real power, the power that Jesus gives, the power to empower others so that we can live and love like him. In his name we pray. Amen. Thanks.